Welcome to QED Book Club, the podcast where one of our favourites is joining us once again. And this just might be her biggest book to date. Dervla McTiernan is here to talk about What Happened to Nina, a story that will really make us all wonder what we might do in someone else's shoes and what we'll do to protect our children. Let's take a listen. Dervla McTiernan, congratulations. What Happened to Nina?
Thank you. Thank you, Victoria. I'm excited.
It is already such a hit. People are loving it.
We're number one fiction after just 3 days last week, so we're very excited about
it. It is absolutely incredible. Did you feel when you were writing this, I mean, you've got a fair few books under your belt now. Did you feel like when you were writing this there was something special about it?
Maybe very, very late, maybe about draft 26, but in the early days you don't really know what you have. But later on, yeah, it started to feel like something a little bit special. And I don't know, I mean, anything I say now is going to sound horrendously boasty, but there was something about the early reviews that felt a little bit different. You know, it just felt a bit more, people were just a bit more excited, you know, when they want to come and they want to review because they want to tell you what they thought. So that gave me a really good feeling early on, and now so far it's going great.
Because, of course, the last time we chatted was after The Murder Rule, which also did fantastically well. And that was a real step outside for you, wasn't it? A real standalone after a series.
Yeah, completely different. I mean, the Cormac Riley series is all set in Ireland. It's sort of police procedural. It's kind of a gentler pace. And then The Murder Rule was set in the States. It had a lot of legal elements to it, possibly paced a little bit faster. So that was quite different for me. And then this is different again.
For those that haven't read too much or known your story, I guess, you're very much grounded in the law, and that's why The Murder Rule was just so fascinating, because you were able to, I don't know, when you know that you've got a law background, you really knew what you were tuning into was real. But that's your background, isn't it, in the law?
I was a lawyer for a long time. Like, I meet a lot of other recovering lawyers out there.
I like that, recovering.
Ran away from it. But I was lawyer for 12 years officially, and then I did kind of quasi-legal work for a few years after that. So, yeah, but I did mostly sort of international contracts, you know, for heavy industry or pharmaceuticals. I didn't do defense law. I wasn't a prosecutor, but I had friends who were, because, you know, you all grow up together, you all train together, and you meet for coffee, you meet for drinks, and you hear all the stories, the backroom stories.
It's interesting that you've got this accent. You're Irish. Your two books are set in the US, but you're and you're living in Australia, so it's quite the international combination.
It can get a little confusing sometimes, to be honest. Where am I right now? But it's fun to be able to take a book wherever you want to take it, you know? Like, I always think about Stephen King, who was my god of writing, and when I open a Stephen King book and I see the list of books that he's written over the years, and I just think, you know, he's the age he is. He has been phenomenally wealthy for many, many years. He only writes for the joy and the love of it. And I think he does that because he writes where the story takes him.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Did you go into this after having written a very much a legal book? Did you think, I'm going to make this completely different? I'm going to make this more of a police? No.
I wish I was that considered.
Okay.
But it tends to be a lot more organic. You know, there's just an idea you really want to write, or a character you really want to spend time with. And then the story drives the structure, and it's always been like that for me, because right, going back to The Ruin, where I just started that book with just the beginning of Maud and Jack, my two characters sitting on the stairs in this Irish house in the countryside, and then I knew I needed a cop for that scene, and then it became a police procedural because of that. And I didn't even think about it that way until after, and my editor was like, yes, it's a police procedural, and I was like, yes,
that's entirely what
I was intending. Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? And how much do you think that law sitting in the back of your mind shapes what you do and how you write?
I think it's helped me because of the way my memory was trained. Yeah. So I think, you know, we have these massive contracts, like there might be 400-page contract and then 200-page appendices. And you need to know that if you change clause 3C, it affects 24C and 6A and 3B and blah, blah.
Yeah, right.
So you keep that in your head.
Structure.
Yeah. So, like, do you ever hear about the knowledge?
Yes.
It's this test that these London taxi drivers have to do, where they have to know where everything connects around. And they did MRIs of the brains of London taxi drivers, and certain parts of their brains are far more active because they've had to train their brains to maintain this memory. And I think my random theory is that if you have had to train your brain to think that way about these big contracts, it helps you hold plots so that you can... That helps.
Yeah.
So I think that bit has been helpful to writing.
So some people have a white storyboard. You've actually got a little white storyboard in your brain that's doing that
for
you.
On a good day, anyway.
I have to begin, I guess, by talking about, as we get into the story, but talking about this incredible cover, because it is like nothing else on the shelves at the moment. And it's this
it's kind of almost jarring. Like, you've got a real person and it's like a photograph. And
yeah.
Tell me, it's fascinating. And tell me about it.
Yeah, I love this cover. I love that it's different from anything else in the shelf. I mean, that's a risk because readers know what they want and they're going into the bookshelf looking for what they want. And then if you give them that something that looks a bit different, they might just walk past. That's what you're worried about. But in this case, that doesn't seem to be happening. And I guess what we liked about the picture from the beginning is that it feels almost true crimey.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know? And it's giving you that feeling of a real case, which is what this book is all about trying to do, you know, make you feel that the people at the centre of it are real people.
And I guess when I think back to Murder Ruled, you know, there was a basis and a grounding for that story. Was that the case with what happened to Nina?
Not really. I wasn't thinking of any one case in particular, but I was thinking about it. I mean, all of the true crime cases that were happening were sort of forming the backdrop. The beginning of this book came from a conversation with a friend of mine. We were sitting over coffee and she was talking about her son. My kids are a bit younger, they're 14 and 12, but her boy was starting college. And she was just talking about her worries for him on nights out. And I was like, well, what are you, he's a gorgeous kid, like, what are you worried about? And she was saying, look, our expectations of young men are changing so fast. And it's not, she wasn't worried about the really obvious stuff, like black and white consent stuff, but she was worried more about the kind of stupid thing an 18-year-old guy will do on a night out after a few beers with friends that a 25-year-old wouldn't do because he's more sophisticated. You know,
his brain's developed.
Yeah, exactly. He's less spontaneous. And, you know, what if one of his friends behave badly and he gets online and supports them when he shouldn't? Or he makes a move that's unwelcome and, of course, he accepts that, but, you know, he offends somebody. The kind of thing that you could apologize for and learn from and move on 10 years ago might now be captured by a photo or a video or a screenshot, it goes online, everybody's talking about it, outrage feels, you know, feeds it, and then it follows you for a long time. And her worry is, like, how do we protect our kids from stuff like that, and how do we prepare them for that? Because we didn't live in that world. And I walked away from that conversation thinking about, like, I never worried about that stuff before. Great, I've now got new worries. But also, the difference between as parents of girls and parents of boys, what we worry about. So that was the very beginning of it. And then loads of other things fed into it as I wrote.
That is so interesting because I was thinking about, like, and particularly looking at that cover, that it is appealing to younger readers because it's got that really, that look and the real person, etc. But now you say that to me, I have a son about to turn 18, and you're right, there are things you worry about in a different case, and my girls are just a bit younger, and you do, you are concerned about very different things and very different moments. Mm. And this on so many levels plays into that because, of course, we've also got parental, this book is about the parents as much as the kids involved. So I guess let's go back because we meet Nina at the very beginning in the prologue, and it's such a surprise because you're upfront with us about Nina, aren't you?
Yeah, we have Nina right at the beginning. So we hear from her when she is going away for a weekend with her boyfriend Simon, and they're going to go to his family's second home for the weekend. He's put a lot of pressure on her to do that. She's blown off her mum. She's supposed to be helping out at the inn to go. And there's a lot of, we can see right in the prologue that there's a lot of conflict in their relationship, that this outward seeming perfection of these two attractive young people who are really in love and seem like such fun on their Instagram, that under the surface things are a bit darker. And she's been scrambling for a while to sort of try and make it work. And she's always been feeling guilty and on the back foot. But, you know, it has slipped into something that possibly, you know, is an abusive relationship.
And that's the thing, they're young, you know, they're 20. And even that kind of American 20 as opposed to Australian is quite a different thing.
Yeah, I think so.
So they've been together since they were 16. So they've got this really established relationship. And as you say, and a relationship online that people have seen and can judge even from the outside.
Mm. And I think that there's, you know, she's someone who sort of feels the need to protect him from his own mistakes. So if he's behaved badly to her, she's not in a rush to tell anybody about that because she really has loved this guy. They've known each other since they were small children. They've been together for years. And so she's sort of protecting the privacy of their relationship without recognizing what it's becoming.
You used a phrase in that opening prologue from Nina when she described her relationship about being like a lobster in a pot of boiling water. That's such a great analogy, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Because it never happens abruptly. You know, you don't go from the great guy to the not so great guy immediately. It's slow, and there's always an excuse, and there's always a reason, and there's very often an apology. And before you know it, you're in very deep.
It's that time of year. Our catalogue is out now for the mums and the other great women in your life. A book absolutely is the gift that keeps on giving. It gives that woman in your life, your mum, your grandma, your carer, time out. I reckon they've earned it. So take a look at the QBD Mother's Day catalogue out now.
Yeah, so they don't. They come back from the weekend, but Nina doesn't come back, but we don't know where or why or what has happened. Mm. I even found that kind of deceived that no one really talked, like no one mentioned that she didn't come back till her parents didn't know for a couple of days.
Yes, this is it.
And that makes your heart stop.
Yes, this is the thing. So Simon comes back and, you know, Nina's due back and her parents are like, where is she? And then they begin to realise he's already back and they start asking questions. And Simon has an explanation for why Nina's not with him, but it doesn't really hold together. It doesn't bear up to close scrutiny. So Nina's parents go to the police and they point the police at Simon. And Simon has to answer questions and his parents go into protective overdrive mode. They hire a defence lawyer, but they also hire this reputation management firm that goes online and starts this vicious no-limits campaign, kind of placing blame on everybody but Simon, spreading rumour, kind of muddying the water to protect his reputation. And they also point the finger at Nina's parents, suggesting that maybe they might have some guilt, something to answer to.
What's frightening when you read it is how quickly and easily that can happen, to hire a firm like that to do something like that. And the things that are said about them and the way social media pounces on it all, you can see it happens because we read it and see it and live it every day.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, sometimes people say to you, well, that seems a bit far-fetched. But most of the time, reality is worse. I mean, there were two PR firms that I researched when I was looking into this. One was a Spanish firm that had, I think, 10,000 clients worldwide. And they offered reputation management services. So they would go online and they would clean up your Google search history. So if someone looked up your name, instead of finding out that you were charged with X, Y, or Z, there would be some puff piece or other. So specifically, for example, they represented a guy who was charged with hiring a hitman to murder his business partner. They represented a guy who was a clown for a traveling circus who was charged with molesting a 13-year-old girl. Horrendous crimes. That firm sort of half disappeared, half morphed into something else. But there was also a firm in the UK called Bell Pottinger, and they were a really high-profile PR firm that worked for the British government, had big contracts with the British government. And they offered...
It's everyone tooting you, by the way, saying today.
Hi, guys.
Dover's here.
They offered PR services to countries that were accused of human rights violations. So what they would do, and they were caught on recording by a journalist, Sting, admitting this or offering these services, what they would do is they would write fake articles, completely making up stuff about how this country had turned around its human rights record. And then they would back into websites owned by like Stanford or government websites so that the search engines would rank these articles higher. So if you searched up this country and said, let me look up country X and its human rights record, instead of finding the actual articles about the terrible things they had done, you would see all these fake articles saying, these guys are great, they've really turned things around.
And then they're listed alongside really reputable institutions.
Exactly, yeah. So it looks good. And then the only reason that company went down is because they went into Africa on behalf of a family called the Guptas, who are very wealthy and very powerful in the region. And to support the Guptas' business interests, they stoked racial unrest by, again, writing fake articles about racial tensions to kind of inflame the region, which helped the Guptas. And when this was discovered, that finally brought that company down. But my question is, in a world where we're not funding investigative journalism, how many of those companies are out there now doing that stuff just a little bit quieter?
Absolutely. And that's like that's on a huge scale, right? That's a country and racial like there are so many smaller individual lives that are at stake.
Absolutely. We know it's happening. We know that we're being manipulated online all the time, but it's difficult to see it sometimes. You know, we all think we're invulnerable, that we're all logical, we all think things through, but that's not how we make decisions in reality.
You've just really made me afraid.
Sorry.
You've made me very, very
bringing
afraid.
Bringing the mood down here today.
But it is fascinating, and to think that the level that it can go to, because then the next layer of that is almost the law firms and the lawyers that these families are used, because Simon's family are very wealthy and quite sort of prominent, so they've got different influence and different power. Mm. And even the types of lawyers that they hired to assist them, I felt like they had extra powers.
Yeah, I think people like that kind of do, because they have connections and expectations that are much higher. It wouldn't have occurred to Nina's parents to go and look for a lawyer. And if they had, they would have gone to somebody in the local town and who might not have a lot of experience in this area, certainly wouldn't have the pull that these other guys have. And it would have been very far at the back of their minds as a priority, whereas Rory's first thought is, who do I call? Who do I call? And he is immediately put in touch with these reputation management guys, and he is immediately put in touch with the right criminal lawyer. And that's what money and power can do.
Absolutely. So you give us the story. It's fascinating the way you do it. the parents all have chapters as well as the police. So we, apart from meeting Nina right at the beginning, the rest of the story is told through those different eyes. And it's good to get an understanding because the families are very different, aren't they?
They're so different. I mean, they're so different. We have Jamie and Rory. So they're Simon's parents. Rory's, as I've mentioned, quite wealthy, a little bit older than his wife. And he's made his money through business over the years. And Jamie, his wife, is very beautiful, but she works very hard at maintaining her beauty. And she's formed this sort of idea that she is going to inevitably at some point be dropped. That at some point Rory will move on to wife number whatever because she's seen it happen so many times. And because their children are older now, a lot of these wives are being left with nothing. And yeah. Jamie says to herself, well, I'm not going to let that happen to me. So because he encourages her to spend money on very expensive clothes and bags and all of that, she does that, but she has the bags quietly remade by a guy she knows in New York. She sells all her clothes and bags after a couple of weeks, and she's been doing that for about 5 years by the time we meet her in the book, so she's built up quite a little nest egg.
Is that a real thing? Because when I was reading, I think, I suppose you could. Like, if you own so much Gucci and Versace and Dior, you may as, like, and you can't wear it again. Social media means you can't wear it 5 times.
Of course.
So that's probably a real thing.
Oh, it absolutely is. Yeah, there are websites online that cater for very expensive, you know, secondhand sales, and there are specific accounts so that some people will follow a particular account so they'll know I'm the same size as this account, so I'll just wait and see what they're going to come up with next.
So Jamie's interesting because she's living this, I'm trying to be the perfect wife to just keep my husband rather than actually have my own life.
Mm.
And she protects that fiercely, and she's obviously got this, as we all do, love for our children.
Yes.
And love for her son, but it kind of warps her view, doesn't it?
It does. And you know, it'll be up to the readers to decide if you think, does Rory actually love Jamie? Is she right in her assumption that he doesn't? She's created this. In her mind, she's absolutely convinced that their relationship is transactional.
Yeah.
And she sort of designs herself around him. And whatever her own private thoughts are, she makes sure that she's pleasing at all times. She does everything that might be expected of her socially. She's always beautifully dressed in the way that she knows he likes. And Simon observes all of that, and you have to wonder to what degree that has impacted him.
Yeah, that's very true. And on the other side, the flip side of it all, you've got two incredibly hardworking people who just what was amazing watching Nina's parents was the impact all of this had on them and their daughter going missing and their other child as well.
Yeah, they're so different. I mean, Leanne is Nina's mum, and she's had a really hard life. I mean, her mum didn't really know how to love her. Her dad wasn't there. And Leanne worked her backside off to get away to college when she was young, but she was a bit unsophisticated. First boyfriend, got pregnant, boyfriend dumps her. She finds herself back living with her mum, who was not very happy to see her. And despite that beginning, with a small child, she managed to build a business. So by the time we meet her, she's built up this beautiful inn over the years. She's worked so hard, but she's afraid for her girls, and she knows how tough the world is. So she sort of tried to make their lives a bit harder, almost imposing this artificial toughness to sort of say, well, I need to toughen them up because otherwise how are they going to survive? But of course, when Nina goes missing then, all she does is blame herself. And she's like, why wasn't I? If I had been warmer, would Nina have come to me? Is this my fault? Which is what we all do. We blame ourselves. Right?
Definitely. And then Andy, the dad, is different. You see the different, those kind of male characters come out, characteristics come out, very different how we see Rory play it, because he's in a different social and status situation to Andy, who just really wants to support his wife and love his daughters, but has that natural kind of male, like, what's going on to my family? Protect them.
Yeah, but he's slow to sort of accept it in the beginning. I mean, I think he's just sort of like, everything's going to be fine, you know? And his wife is like, well, what's the evidence for that, you know? Which leaves her feeling quite alone, because he's not really accepting the reality in the first little period of time. And then, of course, you know, things move on.
They do move on. Now, you do give us, I love that we sort of had a thought about this, you did give us a lot more information earlier in the book than I anticipated. So what that meant for me was the book went a whole different way than I thought, which was actually great. And it became more about the people on the outside. It became more about the families and how they managed it, and how the police managed it as well.
Yeah, I always saw this book about the parents. I always saw that we felt it this way. We've got two sets of parents and their lives are continuing. And then this bomb goes off in the middle of their lives. And the bomb, of course, is Nina's disappearance. And from that moment forward, everybody takes this one small step sideways.
Yeah,
and it's this, like, they're traumatized. Plus, everything's heightened because of all this media attention.
Yeah.
And then, so they're not living in the world that you and I are living in. They're living in a world that's, like, almost slightly parallel, but just different. And they start making decisions that maybe you and I might not make, or maybe we would, but they're reasonable in the situation. Leanne makes a decision which provokes a response, which provokes a response. And it escalates so fast. And I wanted it to be that you're 5 days in and the character is looking back at the person they were on Monday and they don't recognize themselves anymore.
Oh, that's exactly what it is, because this unfolds and unravels so quickly. And you do find yourself thinking, not only would I do that, would I say that, but just also, oh, that's how it can happen. So when you see parents at a press conference talking and appealing for someone to help find their daughter, you wonder how it got to there, but it happens fast, doesn't it?
So fast. You haven't had time to think or process. And it's easy to judge people in that situation and say, well, that was weird. Why did she say it like that? But nobody's normal in a situation like that. There is no normal. You haven't slept. Your child is missing. Your brain isn't even functional. You're just doing the next thing that's in front of you.
And we talked about that kind of reputation management and all of that stuff that can go online and what we see and what we hear. But this also looks at it from another level as well, because the public begin to judge. Everyone forms their own opinion, partly by what is being put out by those organisations, but also partly because we're all far too opinionated and judgmental. And so these families on both sides are dealing with that as well.
Yeah, it's this whole rise in like online commentary about these sorts of cases, and it's been happening for a long time. But I did a lot of research into it as well, and we were a lot of the research was talking about outrage culture online and why, you know, it's an outrage economy online, but also why we're drawn to that and what the result of it is. And one of the big themes that was coming from the research I was reading was about normalization. So, you know, we as humans we adjust very quickly. And so if the algorithm is feeding us stuff that is outrageous, because that's what we lean into, we get inured to it really quickly. So something that you and I might have seen on Facebook 5 years ago, I can't believe that person said that. That's terrible. Now we wouldn't even blink.
Yeah.
You know, but it's awful. We've had really, truly terrible cases. Like, for example, this one we can probably talk about because it has been resolved. Cleo Smith, the little girl who was taken from her parents' tent in Western Australia, she was so small. She was taken from the tent. The parents were cleared by the police within, I believe, certainly 48 hours, if not even earlier. But there was a Facebook group set up with like tens of thousands of members saying absolutely horrific things about the parents, who were going through the worst trauma any of us could imagine, to the degree that Mark McGowan had to go to the press and say, can we please stop? Can we please stop? Because this is not okay. They have no involvement. That's already been proven. This is traumatic. Now, in that situation, Cleo thankfully was found and she's safe and well, and we all know exactly who did it, and he's been charged and he's been convicted. And so there, the parents can move forward with a clean reputation. But in many cases, we never get the full truth. And the people who have been accused, they've got to get on with their lives. And when you Google their name, what do you get? Did he murder his niece? I mean, imagine having that follow you, and it's based on nothing. Sorry to go on about this, but there was...
But you know, it's true, though. And if you think back, like we think about now, it's so compounded because of social media, but you can think back to Lindy Chamberlain. You can go back to Maddie McCann.
That's true.
I mean, these stories have been around for decades, and you will still go back and see those. But it is so much worse now because it never goes.
It never goes, and it gets exaggerated. But you're right, we've always done this. I just feel like it's getting worse.
So much worse.
We're more confident about it, I think. There was a case in the US recently where the college students were murdered in their rooms, and again this person has been found and charged, but a college professor was accused of arranging the murders by a vlogger based on evidence she said she had seen, and the videos were viewed millions of times, and the evidence turned out to be a tarot card reading. I mean, you can't do that stuff and get away with it, but people do.
And I think that's also, you know, when you talk about what's happened in more recent years, the breakdown of the changes with Meta and with Twitter and Elon Musk, like there's so much that goes on and the changes that people don't, I feel like people have almost stopped trying to keep up or fact check.
Yeah, we just give up. We have a feeling about whether something's true or not. And most of us, in fairness, I think most of us are not actually engaging. I think there's a silent majority that are just going, okay, whatever, I'm moving on, because I just can't. How do I deal with this influx of information that I think is mostly wrong? I don't know what the next step is. I don't know how we restart a conversation that is not including all of this. Yeah. I don't know what it is, but I think we will find a way. We just haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think there's so much of that now within society. So when we started this book with Nina in the prologue, and we actually, because of the education, what's going on in the world right now, we could see there's a young woman in trouble and this is a dark path. Mm. And so I feel like that those conversations and books like this are kind of highlighting those stories.
Yeah, gosh, haven't we had a few of them, particularly in the last couple of years. So hopefully the conversation will bring us forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So I felt a bit like this is, you're right, there's cases in the US that you can think of that this had elements of. Is it the type of thing you could see being made into something? Because I feel like I'd love to see the story on the screen. It's
maybe
so interesting. Oh, is that, have I said something?
Might be like a week early to talk about that.
Okay,
one, but we're
sorry,
getting,
I didn't know that. I just feel like, yeah, like it's a story that would just be so compelling.
It feels like it could be something that would work on screen. I would like to see it happen. I think it would be really fun to see how we could tell that story differently.
Do you see characters when you're writing them? So are you seeing Nina? Are you seeing Leanne?
Yeah, to some degree, but have you? There's been this thing online recently where they're showing a picture of an orange in different stages of resolution, and they're saying each of us has a different ability to actually envision something really clearly. So you see like an orange blob, or you see it absolutely perfectly resolved. I think I'm somewhere in the middle on
that orange blob in the middle.
Somewhere sort of here. It's vaguely orange shaped. So I don't picture a specific person. It's more of a feeling. Like they feel very real. I know their thoughts and feelings, and I have a vague idea about physical looks.
I love that. I love it. I do want to also mention the police aspect to this, because Matthew, our central sort of police figure, and a young officer who he brings in, I really loved that relationship, the way you had this man mentoring this young woman, and he immediately, you know, a lot of police stories, the men are always just a bit ego.
Yeah.
He actually recognised a young woman who was doing some good work and trusted her, which I loved that element. But also the way you had that running, the police side of things was almost running alongside, so things were unfolding.
Yes.
And you just gave us pieces along the way that you started to get confidence that it might be okay, but we weren't quite sure.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. I always wanted them to be reality, whereas the parents are in the slightly surreal world. And I needed to show that, you know, as the writer, I know that what the parents are up to isn't exactly 100% rational. There is a real world that's continuing, and the police chapters are almost like a metronome in the background. Like, this is, the investigation's going forward. It is progressing. They're not telling the parents everything because they can't, but they're doing their jobs, and it's tick, tick.
And he just kept saying, just trust us. We'll do the best. We'll do our jobs.
Yeah.
That was a metronome. Thank you.
Glad.
Ah, here's the thing. There are so many things. I can't tell you about this book because it will ruin it. But it is just so clever and just so smart. Dervla, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks for your company on QBD Book Club, the podcast. Back soon with more author insights.